You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
Sunny and clear for the indefinite future. Yes, we're recording this program on July 9th for broadcast on July 10, 2025. Temperature today is going to be 93 degrees, which is our exact average high temperature at this time of year in the Davis area. Tonight's low will be 63. The National Weather Service says for Davis, Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 101 degrees. Thursday night will be 64 degrees. Friday will be 101 degrees. Friday night will be 61 degrees. Saturday, 97, going to a low of 60. Sunday, 97, going to a low of 59. Monday, cooling down to 97 degrees, going down to a low of 59. Tuesday, 93, back down to average high temperatures for this time of year. And this is going to be just another high pressure ridge, just like the last three that we've had so far this year, where it's going to set up and we're going to get hot during the middle of the afternoon. And the closer you get to the coast, the lower that high temperature is going to be. So if you take this very fun site, Ventusky.com, which I've referred folks to many times, it's this great graphic, and you can go there and you can set up for looking at Friday at 5 p.m., which 5 p.m. is typically our highest daytime temperature. And on Friday in Sacramento, they're saying it's going to be 102 degrees. And then you just take your cursor, and you drag it down the interstate. Oh, look, Davis, 98. Oh, look, Vacaville, 92. Oh, look, Fairfield, 89. So strong gradient as you go towards the coast. And that's been the pattern this year. When we have high temperatures in the forecast, we're getting stronger coastal influence than was expected. And the Davis area, Vacaville, Dixon, even to Woodland, are typically getting a couple degrees cooler than the predicted high temperatures. So we have actually not broken 100 degrees officially in Davis. And today is July 9th. That's really unusual, folks, if you don't happen to be from this area. We may break it, and some people have in their backyard weather stations been over 100 degrees a couple times, but relatively speaking, the story of this year's weather is mild weather so far all the way through to the second week of July. However, the ET rate, evapotranspiration rate, which is an important data point for those of you trying to schedule irrigation, it's running 0.29 inches per day, which means that your full week of irrigation, if you're watering at the full evapotranspiration rate, would be about 2 inches. Even though it's cooler than usual, we still need to water, and we need to water deeply. And our most common conversations that we've been having at our garden center are about, you need to water deeply. I think we've mentioned that a few times over the last few weeks, so we can just leave it at that. How's that?
That's very good. Yeah. I have a question regarding, you said there were differences from Sacramento to Davis to, you know, all that stuff. But how are the measurements taken? I'm wondering if when someone sets up a weather station at their house, maybe they do it differently. In other words, is the thing totally encased? Is it shaded? Is it sunny? How are those measures taken?
Weather stations are standardized, so that's the good news. So if it's a National Weather Service or something like that, or one of the CIMIS weather stations, there is a standard format for how they are to be set up where they are supposed to be that is supposed to account for the very likely microclimate differences you would get just putting it in your backyard on your patio, for example. That would be wildly inaccurate to just have people randomly putting thermometers and hygrometers and stuff wherever they choose. We need some basis for comparison. So the CIMIS weather stations have a format. You can even go onto that site and look at pictures of their examples of their weather stations. They have a certain amount of turf around them. They're out in the open. They're not up against a building. So they don't have the microclimate problem. However, that also doesn't reflect the microclimate advantage or disadvantage that home gardeners will be experiencing. So when I'm telling you it's only going to be 98 in Davis, in your patio with a west-facing wall is going to be 104, okay? Because of the microclimate you've created by the way you built your building, laid out your yard, poured concrete, painted a wall. Those are all decisions you make that affect what it feels like to you to be out there. One of the things I like about Weather Underground or wonderground.com is that you can go to Davis and you'll see the weather station, whatever one they're linking to. I haven't ever quite figured out their formula. But then on the same page, a whole bunch of local weather stations that are also reporting in. And you can see some neighborhoods you'll recognize, and they'll be warmer or cooler thanks to trees, thanks to the microclimate that particular station is in. So this is when the way you laid out your yard is making a big difference. I had a customer a few years ago who planted, just made use of a space on the west side of his house where he had a lot of room. He had a fairly deep, you know how most of you have that side of your yard where the trash cans are and you've only got like 6 feet of space and you can't really do anything with it. His was wider. He had room for a bed. So he planted 4 tomato plants in there facing west. They grew great. He had to give them a lot of water. We talked about that. It was a hot exposure. So he had to give them a lot of water. They grew fine. I had pictures of them because he kept bringing them into me to show me that they were flowering and not fruiting. All 4 varieties.
Because it was getting hotter there than the rest of the house.
Yes, he was probably not going to get fruit there until very late in the season because he had a microclimate there that was just cooking. And so it would be 5 to 6 degrees hotter on that side of the house at a crucial time of day when the fruit, you know, when the blossom would be pollinating and setting fruit. So when we tell you these rules like tomatoes don't set above 90 degrees, he was never going to get a day where it wasn't above 90 degrees on that side
in that place, yeah,
until maybe very late in the season. Now that might be a good place for a tomato to carry you for fruit into the winter. I don't know, but he had created a microclimate with several degrees of difference. But for fun, if you haven't seen ventusky.com, check it out. It's a great model with fantastically cool graphics, and you can just take your cursor and go down the freeway and say, you know, it's going to be really hot on Saturday. Go to Fairfield. Actually, even better, go to Bodega Bay, where it's going to be 67 degrees. Go to Fort Bragg, where it's going to be 65 degrees.
That's our lows, 67.
Yeah, their highs will be our lows. Yeah.
So, Don, I have a technical question here. Do you know of a device or an app, I should say, where you have little thermometers that you can place around your house and have them all report to your phone, and you can keep track of how warm things are in different areas. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Oh, yes. Weather nerds have them, and they basically look at them more for the winter. Those are great. And I don't have a brand. I do not have one of these myself. I've thought about buying them. And then I thought, you know, all I will do is stare at that data. I really don't need that information. But I do have customers who are, for example, very into subtropical fruits. Members of the California Rare Fruit Growers are often growing things that they're stretching their zones. You know, they're growing dragon fruit, for example. I have a customer who grows dragon fruit here in Davis. Dragon fruit is a cactus. It's a USDA zone 10 plant. We're in USDA zone 9. So to grow it here, it's like growing a jade plant. You need a sheltered wall with an overhang. She's got a thermometer that feeds right in. She travels a lot. She's an expert and does a lot of conferences and such. So she can check her phone in Lithuania or wherever she happens to be and go, oh my goodness, looks like tonight it's going to get down to 27 degrees outside. Oh, look, the thermometer is already reading 31 where the dragon fruit is. She can text her partner can drop down the screen that protects the dragon fruit. She can get 2 to 4 degrees protection from that particular sheet or whatever that drops down. She can monitor it overseas. So yes, those weather stations do exist, and weather nerds are out there who have them. They can give you readings and feed into your by Bluetooth or whatever to your phone. What you do then is up to you, but it's mostly for monitoring cold temperatures. I think it would be interesting to have them all over your yard and show you why that patio that you set up to have visitors over to go sit out in the late afternoon is never comfortable for that. But, you know, intuitively, you probably know it's because of the reflected wall that's building the heat in that area. It does remind us that things like gravel, concrete, asphalt, hardscape surfaces make a significant difference in the summer to making areas less livable. In the winter, they can provide some plant protection. So sometimes these are trade-offs that we make. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you folks to fund our operating costs. And you like what you hear, if you like all the amazing programming here on KDRT, head over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. We've got various events that sound really cool. So I'm going to start with let's go mothing. Let's go mothing.
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 Mothing?
The boat, our old friends at the Bohart Museum of Entomology are hosting Moth Night on Saturday, July 12th. So they will have their annual Moth Night. This is very popular. Saturday, July 12th from 7 to 11 p.m. at the facility at room 1124 of the Academic Surge Building on UC Davis. Just go to, well, now it's changed, Entnem. Entnem, which stands for Entomology and Nematology. Entnem.ucdavis.edu and look for Let's Go Mothing. It's an open house which features a black lighting demonstration. Scientists will hang a white sheet and an ultraviolet light to attract night flying insects. They have the moth collection, crafts, microscopes, live animals, catching moth demonstrations. I could tell you some great stories. I grew up with a butterfly and moth collector. Very entertaining to travel with them. Some hornworm caterpillars for handling, says Tabitha Yang, the education and outreach coordinator. They often find species that come in to the black lights and they identify them for you. And lots of other things that aren't moths are also attracted to the black light. So you'll get an opportunity to see what a lacewing looks like, for example. Last year, a longhorn beetle showed up. That's entertaining. And so they have people there that will tell you what these things are. We probably, estimates the curator of the Bohart Museum's Lepidoptera collection, have around 500,000 moths in the Bohart collection. Not flying around. Those are deceased. We currently are incorporating another tens of thousands of butterflies, the remainder of the lifelong collection from Bill Patterson, a longtime butterfly collector and supporter of Bohart, gifted $1 million to the museum in 2022 to help maintain their permanent insect collection. You can still find all this information by going to bohart.ucdavis.edu. I see the URL has changed, but just go to the Bohart Museum Moth Night, Saturday, July 12th.
At 1 o'clock or at 7 o'clock or 7. At 9 o'clock? What time?
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
Yeah.
All right. Another message here. This one is from Tara in Oakland. And she writes, good morning. One of my worst garden mistakes has been a vine. The purple passion flower aggressively sent up shoots many feet away, never fruited, wasn't fragrant, and refused to be killed by hard freezes in Georgia. Please help me avoid making another vine mistake. My husband has been admiring Lunicera heckrotii, the gold flame honeysuckle, and I fear the generally aggressive reputation of honeysuckle. Is this particular one a garden thug? I've been lobbying for an edible passion fruit. Are there any passion fruit that are not unruly giants? We are in Oakland, and I envision planting the winning vine along the base of our full sun north-facing patio rail. And she sent a picture of the location. Thank you. So shall we talk about that one first, Don?
Yeah, gold flame honeysuckle is a very well-mannered honeysuckle. It's one that I actually don't mind selling. The genus Lunicera, which is all the honeysuckles, includes some extremely rambunctious plants, Lunicera japonica, for example, which is highly invasive. But there are other members that are just nice 10 to 15 foot woody plants that they're a vine. So you need to decide where they're going to go and train them, but they're not garden thugs. And that includes the gold flame honeysuckle and the Dropmore scarlet honeysuckle, which is a different species. That's Lunicera sempervirens. These are both hybrids. They grow quickly to about 10 to 15 feet. They have very lightly fragrant flowers. I want people to understand that these are not the sweet, almost overwhelming fragrance of the Japanese honeysuckle and some of the other types. So if you're looking for fragrance, they're not that fragrant, but the hummingbirds love them and they're not overwhelming. I do want to mention two that I've mentioned, gold flame and Dropmore scarlet. They get aphids. They're always going to get aphids. They get this black aphid that is very common on them. Anytime I look at the aphids that are on them, they're being parasitized, at least in our area. So the problem solves itself, but people do get concerned about it at times. However, it doesn't really disfigure the plant and you don't really have to do anything about it. So as long as you can tolerate some aphids on this vine, they become a breeding source for beneficials because you've got these parasitoid wasps that come in, parasitize them, increase, spread out to other things in your yard and take care of aphids on other plants. I just want you to know they do get aphids, but no, neither of these, the Dropmore scarlet or particularly one that he's intrigued by, the gold flame, neither of them are particularly rampant. And we have a native honeysuckle, Lunicera Hispidula, I think. I'll double check that, which is a California native that's got a pretty light pink flower. And that one also is not overwhelmingly invasive. So either of them are good possibilities for a backyard. Edible passion fruit are very, very, very vigorous plants. In the valley here, where we're in Sunset Zone 14, USDA Zone 9, they freeze back almost every winter. So you definitely would want to look for a microclimate for an edible passion fruit if you're in the interior. Otherwise, they keep getting killed back. They regrow. They don't really have time to grow flower and fruit because they're always recovering from last winter's injury, unless you happen to have a south or east facing wall or a fence that has some concrete nearby that helps to trap some heat in the winter time, or you're in a place where you're willing to cover it over. We have one planted at our garden center on the fence right along the driveway. And it never gets more than about fence height because every winter it freezes back. Every winter it comes back. We've never actually seen fruit on it. So if you're really growing it for the fruit, you should probably plan, if you're in the interior, for where you're going to plant it so that you can either protect it or will be in a microclimate that provides natural protection. In Oakland, I don't think that's going to be a problem for you. I think you will find it's a very vigorous vine. Not as bad as the purple one you had in Georgia. That one is well known for being very vigorous, and I would say, go ahead and say invasive. Generally speaking, passiflora are 20 to 30 foot vines, vigorous, lush vegetation, require every 2 to 3 years of sort of a hard pruning just to keep them from getting to be an absolutely overgrown tangle and rat infested thing. But if you're willing to do all that, they're easy to grow. And in relatively frost-free climates, such as coastal California, they can become very vigorous plants, even the edible forms.
Yeah. So with this particular passiflora, you said it freezes back in our area.
Yes.
But where it is robust, where it is vigorous, would it be enough to contain it, to put it in a planter? Or is it the kind of thing that if it touches the ground, it roots?
It'll root out of the container into the ground below almost for sure. They sucker. It's the main thing that passifloras do. They sucker from the roots, not just from the base, but from the roots. And so the plant, I dealt with one in La Jolla, California, which is frost free. I planted it myself. I should have known better because 20 plus years prior, my mother had planted passifloras on the same property. And they went everywhere. So 5-6 feet from the plant you put in, a couple of years later, they'll start popping up from the roots. And that can be a nuisance. So it's not a bad idea, as with trumpet vines, if you have them confined somehow. Now, looking at this picture, it looks like they might be confined because there's sort of a planter zone there. But yes, they root sucker. They don't all do it as vigorously. There are 4,000 species and cultivars in the genus Passiflora. The Passiflora Society can give you overwhelming amount of information on this topic about which ones are vigorous, which ones are rampant, which ones are truly tropical, what you wouldn't even grow in Oakland, and so forth. So it's not, you know, they're not all identical, but the popular ones in the trade, including the edibles and the 6 or 7 varieties that are widely sold by nurseries that are flowering passion flowers, they will spread. And I want people to know that. They vary as to how vigorously they spread, but they will spread, especially if you're in a frost-free climate. There's lots of passifloras that are ornamental, and some of them set fruit that doesn't happen to be particularly edible. That can be a bit of a nuisance. They're lovely vines. They're amazing. They're great for pollinators, but many of them are very, very vigorous.
All right. And Tara has a question. I'm potentially on the verge of making another garden mistake. I know to be careful with mint.
Mint. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yes. I have a bare slime shrubby tree in a large fixed patio box. On the shadier side, someone planted maybe bindweed. On the left side, I'm thinking about planting mint for its fragrance when brushed against and to cascade over the edge. Will its competitive behavior harm my bare slime roots over the long run? And then she sends a picture of this morning glory type plant.
Isn't that pretty? And it's a blue flower. So this tells us that it is not bindweed. Actually, this is a very cool garden plant that somebody put in. It's the only plant in the nursery trade that I'm aware of from the nation of Mauritania. So for the longest time, I knew this by the name Convolvulus mauritanicus. And it is a ground cover relative of morning glory with a purple blue morning glory flower on a little ground cover plant that doesn't climb and doesn't outcompete things. It's a very, very well-mannered member of the morning glory family. Now, I happen to have, morning glories are one of my absolute favorite flowers. It's one of those things that I want to plant, but I don't in general. Planted some this year out in my vegetable garden. We'll see how it goes in terms of keeping them under control. The flowers are incredible. They're really fast growing vines. That's your basic morning glory. And there are perennial forms of morning glory that are even worse than the annual forms in terms of taking over your yard. This is.
You recommended that perennial to me 25 years ago.
Did great, didn't it?
I planted it. I am still trying to get rid of it.
Okay, you're talking
I have a redwood with lots of stuff. I'm talking about the perpetual morning glory.
Perpetual, yes, that's a good term for it. You're talking about Ipomoea acuminata, the Blue Dawn Sky Flower, which we've stopped selling completely because I just felt people were going to put it in place. It would turn out to be a problem. It's a great plant in its place. But we put one in. We're getting way off track here, but don't worry, folks. We'll come back. We put one in out front at our garden center 20 years ago. We put on a little trellis way down at the west end of the bed, which is a really hot spot. And I thought maybe that would constrain it. It didn't do really well there, actually. It was too hot, too dry. But it did sneak around the corner behind some Nandina and then behind another plant. And it had insinuated itself within 3 or 4 years through the entire front bed. Well, it's very pretty in bloom. One of the annual jobs of newest employee was to put on some gloves because there is a toxin in the stem of that plant that can make you feel kind of sick. So wear gloves when you're pulling it down. And what you're going to do is you're going to pull it down, pull it out repeatedly. We've almost got it under control 20 years later. We have one little piece of it that I noticed had popped up way back behind a shrub, climbed up through a barberry of all things. So that'll be fun. Convolvulus is the genus that includes some ornamental plants and some rather invasive plants, but this particular one is a very well-mannered plant, Convolvulus mauritanicus. It's a little ground covery perennial. It gets about 2 to 3 feet across and has a little blue morning glory flower. How cool is that? So you don't need to worry about this one particularly. Mint. I have planted many forms of mint. I like things that take over because I'm on a rural property. So I'm very happy if a spearmint plant wants to cover 10 or 15 feet of space. Great. More power to it. When it's in bloom, you've never seen more butterflies and pollinators on a mint plant, on any plant than on a mint when it's in flower. So mint can be great in many ways, but they do spread. So pretty soon your mint plant is a mint ground cover. My own experience is that peppermint is less rampant than spearmint. So if you're choosing between them, it's shorter growing, it's a more moderate grower, easier to keep under control, and it's great for beverages and things like that. So peppermint might be a better choice than spearmint. A Barris lime, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a true lime. It's sometimes called the Persian lime. When people come into my store in the valley, USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14, and they want a lime tree, this is the one I will sell them because it's actually cold hardy and can be grown here. The Mexican lime, the one that's the true bartender's lime or the key lime for key lime pie, is not hardy in the interior. So if you go to a nursery in Southern California, you might see both of these, Mexican lime or Barris Persian lime. We only sell the Persian lime here. The thing that confuses people about it is that the fruit is yellow when it's fully ripe. You can use it green, but it ripens yellow, unlike the Mexican lime. Other than that, it's a true lime. It's a great choice. Strong grower. Even on a dwarfing rootstock, it would get 10 to 12 feet if you allow it to. It's often sold on its own roots. It's one of the few citrus that is grown from cuttings rather than grafting. So like the Meyer lemon, about equal chances if you go to a garden center that you'll get one that's on its own roots versus one that's grafted. In that case, it'll still try to get to 10 to 12 feet. It'll definitely hold its own against the mint underneath it. So I'm not concerned about the mint outcompeting the lime tree, assuming that the lime tree is established. And if that's what's in this picture that I see there, it's already 4x4. It's got vigorous growth. It'll hold its own against the mint. I think that would be a great choice there. You just might want to look into peppermint rather than spearmint because of the lower growth habit and the less vigorous characteristic. So I think that would work very well. Great picture because it gives us lots to work with here.
And Tara closes her message with, I continue to enjoy starting my Saturdays with your excellent, informative show.
Well, thank you.
We have a question here. And that is from Tanya. Hi, Don and Lois. I live in Sacramento. I purchased one of the Tacoma Oompa Loompa dwarf trumpet vines.
Yeah.
Dwarf trumpet bush.
Yeah.
Last fall for myself and two of them for my friend who lives lower in the valley. The plants look healthy, but there is no sign of flowers on any of these three plants. Do you have any suggestions for what the problem might be, if there is a problem, or is this variety just a dud?
I don't think it's a dud. I just think, is it a
Aside
dud?
from photos of the Oompa Loompa and its tag, I'm sharing a photo and short video of my bed of Cosmos Diablo. The pollinators are buzzing all around, and bright summer color just brings joy.
Look at this. This is just packed with cosmos. So let's talk about that for a minute. As I've said many times, cosmos is one of my favorite flowering plants to put out in or near the vegetable garden because they bloom almost no matter what you do. They're kind of wispy foliage, so it's not going to like compete with or crowd your tomatoes or pepper plants. They pop up with their blooms poking out from nearby plants. This is a bed that's chock full of cosmos, and the Diablo series is the shorter yellow and orange range of cosmos, as opposed to the taller pink ones, the Sensation series, the ones people are perhaps more familiar with. All kinds of bees and butterflies and hummingbirds come to cosmos. Just a great plant. And this particular one, Diablo, is one that came out probably 20, 30 years ago. Fairly consistent color range on that one. As she knows, the pollinators are buzzing all around it. Now, the question about the Oompa Loompa. First of all, breeders, would you stop putting these weird names on plants? I'm a nursery owner, and people walk in, they want a plant, and I'm standing there saying, well, there's this Oompa Loompa over here. I feel like, you know, is this McDonald's or something? It's a great plant. Tacoma is a southwestern American native shrubby vine-like plant, which gets into a whole separate conversation. Drought tolerant, they bloom on new growth. So the new growth comes on, blooms terminally. So you can prune them as hard as you want, and you'll still get bloom, but they really like heat. They really like warm temperatures. And there's been some interesting conversations locally. Sacramento Digs gardening blog, for example, run by Debbie Arrington in Sacramento. These colder night temperatures we've been having, imagine we'd be complaining about this. These colder night temperatures were one night a week ago, it was 49, 50 degrees, 51, 52 degrees. That's actually lower than some of these subtropical plants prefer. We're not having a problem. We're just getting, her comment in her blog was, delayed ripening, for example, on tomatoes. They're setting, they're following the pattern they should, but it nights have been cold enough to slow down the ripening process. My guess is that's all you're seeing, unless someone's been pruning it. Pruning things that bloom on new growth means you won't see much in the way of blooms. So that would be one thing if someone's been pinching it or cutting it because of where it is or they want to get it bushier. It doesn't hurt the plant, but it would delay the bloom. So my guess is it'll come into bloom for you as the summer progresses. And as the plant gets bigger and woodier and established, you'll get bloom almost no matter what. These are a really tough group of plants. And what we like about them is you can plant it and grow it like a shrub. So you can, and you can cut it because it blooms on new growth, or you can just let it grow more like a vining thing. It's not a true vine, more of a sprawly shrub, but you can tie it up on a fence. You can tie it up 8 to 10 feet if you want, or keep it as a 4 foot shrub. So these have become very, very popular. I haven't been able to figure out the exact parentage of all these new hybrids that are coming on the market. So they're just selling them as Tecoma, T-E-C-O-M-A, and then single quote, whatever the cultivar name is, Oompa Loompa or whatever. And they're turning out to be very, very popular garden plants. They're bright colors, yellow, orange, dark, almost red, are now available. The British have been having a lot of fun breeding these. American Southwestern plant has really caught on in Britain. And nurseries are selling them like crazy. My guess is you're just seeing a younger plant that isn't well established enough to be blooming, and the night temperatures might have been a factor. But I think the Tecomas are a great group, not to be confused with, though closely related to, Tecomeria, which is a Cape honeysuckle. It's not a honeysuckle. We just love common names. Tecomeria capensis, big sprawling plant, been on the market for 60, 70, 80 years. And that's really much more of a viney growth habit, but it's, again, a very tough plant and extremely attractive to hummingbirds. So I think this, as a group, they're great. Just be aware that it might have been affected by the cooler nights is my best guess.
On both of the things she asked about, the Tecoma and the cosmos, are those things that could tolerate living in east morning sun, but then shade all afternoon?
Yeah, and we've used some of these Tecomas in places where they're only getting part day sun, and they bloom very well. They just stretch more. So think of it more as more of the vine-like habit than the shrub-like habit. I'm using the term vine rather imprecisely here because these aren't true vines in any sense of the word. They're just arching, sprawling shrubs that take well to pruning. But yes, morning sun would be sufficient for them to bloom. Just give it a little more, plant on a little more height on it.
And does it root from a stem touching the ground? You say it's arching.
They root. That's how they're grown. I don't think it's a plant that's going to root in the sense of taking over your yard. No, I've never seen that happen with any of these.
The place that I'm thinking about, I'm not going to be able to ever get into it again.
Right.
It's planted.
You're going to hack your way in, plant something, and that's that, right?
I can't be stable enough to get in there again. So once it's planted, it'll have a sprinkler system on it, and okay. That's it.
This would
so
be a good...
I don't want something that's going to, you know, spread every couple of feet.
Well,
I'm not
be...
going to plant another morning glory.
Yeah, no morning glory. No, and no honeysuckles for you. Well, some of them might work, but what you would be looking at is this whole category of plants, actually. And this is a good segue. Well done. There's a whole bunch of plants that nurseries sell as vines that aren't really vines. They're big, arching, sprawling shrubs. And the Tacoma is a good bougainvillea. I mean, Californians know bougainvillea. It's not a vine in any true sense of the word. It doesn't twine around things. It doesn't hold on with tendrils. It doesn't root into things. Those are the three characteristics of vines that make them climb up onto things. It's just a big, sprawling, woody plant. So bougainvillea, Tacoma, Tecomeria, you can put them in a place, more or less train them to a structure or a fence if you want to, if you're able to get in and do that. And then someone can keep cutting them back to that framework, or you can just let them go. And in the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, right near UC San Diego, practically every house had a bougainvillea. I think in San Diego, it's practically mandatory. You have a bougainvillea and a hibiscus in your yard. Every yard I worked in as a teenager had both of those things. Of the two, I prefer the hibiscus because the bougainvilleas were thorny. But these are examples, bougainvilleas, Tacoma, Gruia caffra, the lavender star flower, Solanum rantinetti, the purple potato vine, now has a different name, Lysianthus. These are not vines, but they're sold as if they were vines because they can be used to provide the privacy that a vine would give. They can be trained up to whatever height you want. It's just a matter of choosing what structure they're going to be on, tying them to that. If you don't do that, they'll just arch outward, like many shrubs do, and fill the corner very nicely. But they are typically not things that root, not things that run up the nearby tree or fence. They're actually better mannered plants than a lot of true vines are. And I've made the comment, and other listener made the comment, that vines have been big mistakes. Yes, they've been some of my worst mistakes, true vines in general. But plants that are just sprawling shrubs that function like vines are rarely a problem because it's pretty easy to get in and cut them back. And even if you can't, it's not like they're going to take over your yard and your neighbors the way the morning glory would, the way the honeysuckle would. There'll be a big thing in the corner, but that's about it. Many roses that we sell as climbers, same thing. They're really just giant shrubs. There's no rose that's actually a vine, but there are plenty of roses that are great big woody plants. So our industry long ago said, call it a climber. There you go. Plant it on a fence, call it a climber, and then prune it more or less two-dimensionally. Hey, look, it functions like a vine. So a true vine, a grape, which holds by tendrils, a passion fruit, which holds by tendrils, a honeysuckle, which twines onto things, a wisteria, which twines onto things. Plan ahead for those because they can become the big problems. It's these woody sprawling plants that are much less of a problem. And if you go to my business website, if you're interested in vines and you want to choose something because you want something for a quick cover, you want some privacy, you want some blooms, you know, there's a bunch of criteria that you might have in mind. I do go ahead and mix all those things on the list you'll find at redwoodbarn.com. Homepage, you'll find plants that grow here. You'll find a whole page of links to lists. And there's one of vines that's on there. I think Lois might have it in front of her. And it's 10 pages of different vines with my descriptions, including ones that are true vines that twine, grab, or root. The ones that root are the worst of all. And also things that we sell as vines that are not really vines. And in many cases, they'll be better choices for you.
And Tanya writes, lastly, on the discussion of oleanders from a previous show, I love oleander. Seeing them along the freeway is something that is quintessentially California. When hosting people from out of state or out of the country, they are always amazed at this plant that blooms in the heat of the summer with no irrigation and looks so pretty along the highways. I grew up out in the country in the Lodi-Stockton area, and we had oleanders bordering our property. If you've got the room for them, they put such a beautiful show. Thank you for the discussion, and sorry if this is long-winded.
That's all right.
I only really needed the Tacoma question answered. Can we get off of the vines thing, or did you want to talk about some more of your choices for stuff.
I would urge you to do research on them. The vines that I do steer people away from, other than just the ones that can really take over your yard, like, morning glory and Japanese honeysuckle. The ones that concern me the most in terms of the damage they can do are the ones that actually root into things. So be very cautious about planting English ivy, which is well known for rooting into whatever it's growing on. That's what it does. That's how it holds itself up. Boston ivy and its relatives to some degree, although it's less of a problem than English ivy, it still is rooting onto whatever it's growing on. This Parthenocissus, Boston ivy, Virginia creeper, the silver vein creeper. They're nice vines in their place. They're not as much of a problem as English ivy, but it's the same thing. They're rooting onto what they're growing on. You decide you want to paint that surface, you're not only going to have to pull it down and detach it, you're going to probably have to like sandblast the surface. So those are two that root onto things. Let's see, the other one I was going to mention is creeping fig, which has been a popular vine in California for many years and literally roots into whatever it's growing on. So if you have it on a house that's got a brick exterior, not common in California, but if you did, that would be fine. But right when it gets to the window frame or the door or the roof, it can do significant structural damage by rooting in and rooting into the wood, pushing its way in between the where the wood is attached, and causing a lot of problems in the future. So, and also creeping fig, which has got a cute little leaf, very adorable little plant, creeps up the wall and everything looks cute for a long time, and then all of a sudden it goes through a hormonal phase change, a maturation from juvenile to mature wood. And all of a sudden, the leaves go from 1 inch to 4 inches, and the plant becomes extremely vigorous. And this is true for ivy as well. And in the case of the ivy, it starts to flower and fruit and reseed itself, and the fruit is toxic. In the case of creeping fig, it will flower and put on these little figs, but more to the point, it becomes extremely vigorous once it goes into the maturation phase. So be very careful where you're planting creeping fig. I don't like to sell it at all. These are the kind that actually can do structural damage. And taking out a yard that's been overwhelmed by a vine is a big, big job. There's a lot of labor involved when you get into that. There's a number of vines that I do find myself recommending, and without any huge concern. Well, one that's very popular is the Dutchman's pipe. It's a sort of a scruffy looking thing, but people like to plant our native Dutchman's pipe, Aristolochia californica, because it's the host plant for the pipe vine swallowtail. So that's the one you put it on a fence and it'll get, it'll cover one section of fence. And you should probably have another vine there that looks nice, because the thing about planting food sources for caterpillars tends to make your plant look a little rough if they find it. So, clematis, we talk about them a lot on the show because to me, it's a vine that gives you more bloom per square foot than anything I can think of, with very, very little input on your part, except just figuring out what they're going to climb on. That's pretty much all you need to do, is figure out what structure they're going to be confined to in that year's growth cycle. And then you just whack the whole thing back when you're done with it and it starts over. They do vary somewhat in that regard. Trumpet vines as a group are pretty overwhelming, but there are some that are not as bad. Pandorea is a good example of a trumpet vine that's well mannered, does well in the interior, just barely. We're just hardy enough for it here. It's just hardy enough for our climate. Coastal areas, it does great, sometimes called bower vine. Hops are a great choice if you just want to screen something off for the summer. This is the same hop that you use in brewing and beer making. It's a vigorous, lush plant, likes lots of water, will grow 15 feet in a single season, completely cover a fence or a wall or something. And then you just completely cut it to the ground in the winter if you wish to do that. So you have essentially an herbaceous perennial vine that is there for summer shade and can be taken away completely as we get into the winter. Mentioned a couple of the honeysuckles. So there's vines that are well mannered, vines that are something that can give you the privacy you're after, and others that'll just become an overwhelming problem. Right now, I'm dealing with the white potato vine that I planted 25 years ago, Solanum jasminoides. It's coming up 30 feet away from ground level runners that went under the leaf debris and rooted in and popped up all the way across the yard from where I planted it. So that's my fault. But it is the kind of vine that does that. So I want people to be aware of that when they plant something like the white potato vine. Keep after it. Put it in a place where that'll be a manageable thing. One of the jasmines, jasmine polyanthem, same thing, runs at the ground level if you aren't careful. And then finally, if you're looking for a great big woody vine and you've got a structure for it, you're going to choose between probably grapes, which are a great choice if you are aware of what you're dealing with. A lot of fruit production might be an issue for you, but lovely vines and nice fall color and all that kind of thing. or wisteria, which is a great big woody plant that needs a solid structure to climb on. So don't just casually plant a wisteria or a grape someplace where you're not going to give it what it needs for support. That was a quick overview of vines. You can go to redwoodbarn.com, click on the What Grows Here link, and read the whole 10 pages about vines and make a choice for yourself.
Well, we have another message. This is from Carrie, who writes, "Here are this year's photos of my young ginkgo tree in Corvallis, Oregon. We planted it in the fall of 2021. There were no issues with the leaves when we planted it, but the next spring, when the leaves started coming out, they're misshapen and yellow, and have been for the past 3 years also. Any idea you may have as to what insects might be causing this? And that would be super helpful. And here's a picture of the damaged leaves and of the home.
The ginkgo, I wanted her to send a picture because, well, leaf distortion can occur from little tiny mites, areophyid mites. I am not familiar with them being a problem on ginkgos. I do see them on my elms, for example, sometimes get them. My walnuts sometimes get them. These are unique, but they cause a blistering. In fact, some of them are called blister mites. It causes a distortion of the growth. But the other common cause of distortion of new growth is certain garden chemicals, particularly the ones that are used on lawns for broadleaf weeds. And so a weed and feed product applied to a lawn where there are shallow roots of a tree planted in the lawn, we see this kind of problem where this is not typically when you're spraying for weeds. When you're spraying for weeds, you're going out, you're spraying just the weeds in that one little area, and which minimizes the amount you're using. And it's not typically lying on the soil or getting in contact with the root or the stem of the tree. But the weed and feed products where they've mixed a fertilizer with broadleaf weed killer or weed killers, and you're treating the whole lawn at the same time you feed it, because that's how they work. You just take the bag and you use it like a fertilizer. We see this kind of distortion very commonly on different species. It seems to correlate more with shallower surface roots. So maples, magnolias, birch trees, we see this very commonly. Ginkgos in the long run should have a deep root system, but a ginkgo tree planted in a lawn that's been treated with any kind of weed and feed post-emergent broadleaf weed killer can get this kind of distortion. And so when I suggested that, their comment was, we will check with our lawn service and see what they're doing. And very commonly, that's what you're dealing with. A lot of lawn care companies will come in and treat for weeds, either with a preventative, like a pre-emergent herbicide that would not cause this, or if there are weeds present, like dandelions or oxalis or things like that, they'll treat with a post-emergent, as the name suggests, it's used for weeds that are already growing. That's going to be typically 2,4-D, MCPP, dicamba, or some combination of those. Those three together are usually sold under the name Trimec, and that'll be on the label of the product you're buying. Personally, not a fan of weed and feed products for this reason. You're applying herbicide in many places in your lawn where there are no weeds, and you're also, to some degree, making a risk for trees that are in the lawn and perhaps for shrubs that are nearby. The typical symptom is buckling distortion of the leaves of the new growth as it comes out. Very commonly, since it's a one-time application and they only do it in the spring, the tree then outgrows it, and by summer, the growth is fine. The leaves that are buckled aren't fine, but the new growth comes along less and less affected. I don't think that in lawns that have trees in them, it's a good idea to apply a weed and feed product. I don't really like weed and feed products in general because I think they cause overuse of certain herbicides, and it's not a great way to go about dealing with your weeds overall. But in this is the main issue. Is that when you apply it to a lawn and there's a tree in the lawn, we don't know what the distribution of the roots is, but sometimes they take up these materials and you get this kind of buckling and distortion of the foliage. It doesn't kill the tree in the long run, but it's obviously not great for it. And it does show you one of the problems with using these kinds of combination products. They were very popular 40, 50, 60 years ago. Still people out there looking for weed and feed products. You see these very commonly at Home Depot, Lowe's, places like that. My biggest concern about those stores is they tend to be all stacked up, a whole bunch of products from Scott's or whatever company all lined up next to each other. They may have signage on them, but nobody there that can answer your questions about the weed killer products that are in them. I really would prefer people be better informed about the pesticides they're buying, including herbicides. And I would personally prefer that pesticides be separated from fertilizers completely. I don't think it's a great idea to be selling people combination products.
And she said later when you talked to her that they use a service, a gardening service. So they are not actually the people who are going out and buying this product.
That's
So
correct.
if listeners have a gardening service, how can they know what the gardening service is using? What products, what chemicals? How do they know that?
Well, you should have a contract with the gardening service, and you should probably make it clear from the start that you'll accept some weeds in your lawn because you don't want them using the combination products. They're supposed to be licensed. Anybody who applies any pest control product, and I'm using the term including herbicides, for hire, in other words, they're billing you for coming and doing that for you, has to be licensed as a pest control applicator. And they have to submit use reports. Well, there's a lot of people who think that weed and feed is some sort of magic thing that doesn't contain pesticides. I've run into this before. They think, oh, it's just a fertilizer that magically kills weeds or something. They don't really understand it. So they may think that if I apply weed and feed, that doesn't really count. I don't really have to have a license for that. I don't have to submit use report. Yes, they do. For any company to do any kind of spraying or treatment of any pest or weed in your yard, they have to have a license. The weed and feed products are a big problem in this regard because people don't really understand that they're actually applying a weed killer, in many cases, to an entire 3 or 4,000 square foot lawn, even if they only had weeds in 100 square feet of it. To me, that's one of the biggest issues with these materials.
You say against the law. Is this a federal law or a
No.
California law?
In the state of California, you have to be a licensed pest control
So
applicator.
she's in Oregon, so we don't know if they're required
I
or
believe it's
not.
also I believe it's also required in Oregon and Washington State and New York State and certain other states. It is a state by state thing. You shouldn't have gardening services casually applying pesticides. And I'm using the term broadly. Pesticide includes herbicides, and dicamba is the active ingredient that's usually problematic.
I want to very briefly, and I will make it very brief, talk about the difference between coincidence and causation.
Correlation and causation.
Yeah, I wanted to talk just a little bit about a little.
Slice of this. Correlation does not equal causation. What is your example, Lois?
No, a little bit more than that. The fact that you intended for something to happen does not mean that the outcome that happened was because of your intention. So the fact that I intended to cure a problem and the problem left doesn't mean that what I did worked.
Yeah, I could mention a bunch of products in the horticulture industry that are based on that whole issue of correlation. Therefore, they're selling you a product that because of they're claiming causation. Fulical is an example. Liquid calcium spray for blossom end rot. I have it on the shelf. You know why I brought it in? I brought in a case 3 years ago because after the third guy, it's always a guy, came in wanting a solution to blossom end rot, and I just kept saying, "Well, there is no solution. The problem's going to solve itself." Well, is there something I can spray on it? Well, sure. I heard there's a spray out there that I can use. There is a spray you can use. Well, this guy told me that he sprayed this on, the problem went away, and I said, "The problem's going to go away anyway, whether you spray it or not." Well, let me just give this a try, and I thought, okay, now here's what's going to happen. He's going to buy it. He's going to take it home. He's going to spray the plant, and the problem will go away because the next tomatoes will come out without blossom end rot. That's not a double-blind study. Okay, you don't have a sufficient cohort of in your sample size there to say that spraying one plant and the problem went away. Therefore, I will now spray all my plants with Folical because that will prevent blossom end rot in the future. Blossom end rot is probably the best example of that. I can't tell you how many different things have been recommended over the years to solve quote unquote blossom end rot, when what solves blossom end rot is the soil temperature warming up and watering more evenly, and the plant outgrows. Grows it. And so commonly in our industry, people still adhere to something I heard at a retail seminar I went to when we were first opening. If they walk in with a problem, they should walk out with a product. And a consultant that I talked with at a seminar a few years later said, I would prefer to say it this way. When they come in with a problem, they should leave with something. It might just be information, it might just be a new plant. It might just be a joke you thought of. It might just be a casual conversation that gets them on the right track. They leave with information or at least emotional sublimation, and they don't necessarily buy something off the shelf and go home and apply it. And I can tell you, back when I used to do consultations, I did a lot of house calls, as we called them. I'd go out and look at problems. It was very educational for me as well as the customers. And after a few years of this, I started saying, let's just go see what you got in your garage right now that might take care of this problem. And the things I would see in people's garages blew me away. Things that had been banned 20 years prior by the EPA. Things that they had gone out and bought one bottle of, 16 ounces, used two tablespoons of for the one time they had the problem, closed up the bottle and put it away a decade prior. And it was going to be there 30 years later because they had bought something to solve a problem that actually didn't need to be solved. And something I have observed is that you can explain the life cycle and how this problem will progress or not. And very commonly, what they leave with is information and a greater degree of comfort about their garden and their landscape. And they don't have to have a product. They know that this will be a couple more weeks, then the problem will go away because we'll be warm and dry, mildew, for example. So if you give them information, they may or may not need a product. I'd much rather have you leave with a plant and a joke than a product that you aren't going to need. Vitamin B was probably the best example of this. Vitamin B as a transplant shock remedy came on the market after hydroponics experiments demonstrated that thiamine or something, I can't remember exactly how they came up with this, was something that plants could be deficient in, and that if they were deficient in it, they wouldn't root well. Well, it was very quickly, I mean, this is the 1960s, it was very quickly determined that there was no basis to that. It was really just a totally misdirected area of research. Vitamin B is manufactured by plants. They don't need it around their roots, and it makes no difference around their roots. So even the very first time I worked in a nursery, 17 years old, we already knew then that vitamin B didn't actually do anything. But this whole market had been created for transplant shock remedies. First of all, what exactly is transplant shock? Well, it's the plant, you know, you're tulling apart the roots, you're putting it in the ground, it's a warm day, the plant will droop, the plant will slowly stop drooping on a day-to-day basis. It's just, you know, the roots reestablishing. So all these products were supposedly going to help the plant regrow roots more quickly and reduce transplant shock. Super Thrive, famous for it, famously marketed for that. Vitamin B products. We all knew by the early 1970s that vitamin B itself didn't do anything. So the manufacturers would still have products. When we opened, there was one called Vita Start, vitamin B. They added a 3% nitrogen solution to it. All right, so you're selling them fertilizer and pretending it's a transplant shock remedy. I didn't feel too guilty about that. At least they're getting some fertilizer. But there were nurseries. I remember one in the Davis area. This wholesaler that sold to us also sold to them. And he said they went through 6 or 7 cases of vitamin B every year because they kept it sitting on the counter by the cash register. And they had a manager there who would say, oh, you're buying all these plants. Did you need some vitamin B to go with that, ma'am? And half the time when you say that to someone, they'll go, oh, do I? I guess I do. And they would buy one as a tie-in sale, standard in retail, upselling, tie-in sales, all the things you learn in retail. Did it do anything? No, until the company put 3% nitrogen in there. At least then he was selling them fertilizer, even if he was pretending it was some sort of a transplant remedy. And it's gotten worse as we've gotten into the age of digital media, because anybody and their uncle can be an expert, and they're going to tell you to use household remedies. They're going to tell you to use this product. They're going to tell you to use that. They absolutely know what causes blossom end rot. And they're the ones that stick a Tums tablet under the plant when they put the tomato in the ground. And hey, look, they didn't get blossom end rot. So that correlation must be the causation.
So, Don, this is the show for the 10th of July. Anything you want to tell me about what is happening, you know, what you're planting, what you're harvesting, what we should be aware of, any warnings or...
Warnings. Your tomatoes are beginning to ripen and things like to eat them. You may have noticed that. Yeah. So the very first tomatoes have been ripening now for most people for about 2 weeks. And as they turn color, you may find that various things like to come along and feed on them before you get a chance to pick them, whether it's ground squirrels, tree squirrels, tree rats, birds of various kinds, you name it. There's lots of things that like to feed on the things you're growing in your vegetable garden. And people get very frustrated. The only answer I have for you is barriers. Or I do have one other answer. As they turn color, pick them and bring them into the house. Because personally, at the moment, I'm dealing with ground squirrels. They're way down at the end of the garden and we get along fine. The ground squirrels and I have a deal. They keep the gophers out of the garden. They can have a few tomatoes. I don't mind that. But they do come in, and tomatoes that are at ground level that are ripening, they do wait politely until they're ripe. They don't actually pick them when they're just off color. So if you're having a problem with polite ground squirrels or impolite tree squirrels or tree rats, who are pretty polite, sort of intermediate, If you see the tomato has gone off of dark green and has gone to breaker stage, you might want to just pick that one and bring it in the house and let it ripen on the counter. I find myself saying this about heat, but also it can be an issue with some of these things that come in just as the fruit is ripening. There's nothing more frustrating than a 16-ounce tomato that you've been waiting and waiting for, and you go out there and find that that was the morning that the squirrels decided to eat it. So picking a little earlier can be one option. And the reply I got to that was, but then you don't get the vine ripened flavor. Okay, then do a barrier. And having said this, the way the algorithms are working on Facebook and Google, just having said this as Lois and I are doing this Zoom show, I know what's going to pop up in my Facebook feed, which is a whole bunch of screening and closure things for your vegetable garden. And they work, I'm told. So if you have a big problem in your area with tree rats or roof rats, as they're also called, or tree squirrels in particular, you're just going to need to put some posts in around your garden and put something over the top to keep them out. That physical barriers are pretty much all I can offer to you in terms of keeping those animals away. But earlier harvest can be something that works very well. So if it's just beginning to turn color, or a pepper that's gone from green to just off green, it will also ripen on your counter. I don't know if you know that. And so picking at least some of them early, especially the bigger fruited ones. My answer to this was to stick the cherry tomatoes way down at the end, and I'm happy to share them with the ground squirrels. That we probably between the two of us, we won't be able to deal with the entire production of a single cherry tomato plant. But do be aware that as they're ripening, things are going to come in and go after them. Occasionally, birds, much more commonly, the big three: ground squirrels, tree squirrels, and tree rats.
So I know that tomatoes are climacteric fruit, meaning that they ripen on your counter.
Yep.
Are plums also, if I pick the plums, will they continue to ripen or
Yeah,
will they?
stone fruits will ripen for more fully on the counter. And this is true of peaches and nectarines. I'm about to go out to my nectar plum. Ever had a nectar plum? It's a cross between a nectarine and a plum. Well, mine is just about to ripen. So that tells me it's time. If I want a bunch of these, I better go out and pick them. They're still hard, but they're softening a bit. And I know that I can bring them in, put them in a tray, put them on my kitchen counter, and they will ripen properly there. So learning to pick your peaches, nectarines, plums, apricots, pluots a little early can get you past some of this damage. You might get a lot more of your fruit if you pick it while it's still firm, but on the path to ripening. And yes, the stone fruits are climacteric.
Well, we usually close with a quote, and today we have one sent in by a listener named Andrew. This is a quote from a book that Hugh Johnson wrote. The first purpose of a garden is to give happiness and peace of mind.
Wait a minute, you said that wrong. Repose of mind.
Oh, well, you read it to me, and I just wrote down what I thought you said. All right, let me try
Take
that.
two.
The first purpose of a garden is to give happiness and repose of mind. I'm not actually sure I agree with that. I thought the first purpose of a garden was to be green.
I think people have different purposes for gardening, but for Mr. Hugh Johnson, apparently it's happiness and repose of mind. We do know that as you walk out into your garden, your blood pressure goes down.
Unless there are squirrels there.
Yes, indeed. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.